Hey there, it's Jill Schlesinger. I'm launching a new show. It's called Money Moves, and your money is going to move. We're going to help you make better financial decisions. We're going to call out the BS you're finding all over social media. We're going to give you actionable guidance to make your financial life clearer, less stressful. We're going to answer your financial questions and take the mystery out of your financial life. Follow and listen to Money Moves with Jill Schlesinger wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. We're going wide today with a variety of hot topics for summer, from diets to kids to exercise safety. But let's begin with the world's shortest ceasefire. Here's Tommy Tucker in New Orleans.
Give him a little warning. We're going to hit him hard tonight, but we'll see how it all works out. President Trump said at the NATO summit, referring to Iran, I would think that means the ceasefire as we know it is over. Lindsay Cohn joins us, visiting associate at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. It seems like Groundhog's Day. Here we are back to, I don't know, at one point we have regime change, then we don't. We have a ceasefire, then we don't. They're cooperating, then they're not. Yeah, I just, I'm no Lindsay Cohn, but it just seems to me that Iran is dragging its feet. They're playing the time game for whatever reason and kind of like dictating what happens at their pace, not ours. Am I missing something?
Well, Tommy, I think that, you know, obviously the president did say, you know, from his perspective, the ceasefire was over, but he also said he wasn't going to object to continuing negotiations. I see this as all part of the bargaining process. As we talked about the last time this happened, because almost exactly the same thing happened 2 weeks ago, of course. And as we talked about then, both, I think the Iranians certainly are pushing the envelope, right? They're trying to see what they can get away with. And that is part of the bargaining process. They don't really have an incentive to escalate too much because they can't really get a better deal than the one they already had. The U.S., on the other hand, also doesn't have much of an incentive to escalate back to where we were because the midterms are getting closer and closer, and we already discovered that we can't get much more out of them than we already got. So I think both sides are really trying to sort of jockey for position for these talks. Now, that being said, that's the sort of strategic perspective, right? If both of them are sort of sitting there calculating, that doesn't rule out the possibility that somebody might make a miscalculation or that somebody is, you know, not understanding the situation clearly. But I don't think that this means that tomorrow we're going to go back to war, right? What we've seen is very, very limited tit-for-tat types of strikes. They look like, to me, they look like testing boundaries. And I think that that is probably going to continue, but the talks will probably also continue.
So I guess what confuses me is I get the testing the boundaries part, and I understand trying to get the best deal you can. But if Iran realizes they're not going to get a better deal than they had, and the United States realizes that, as you said, midterms are coming up and that we're going to have to do this and have to do that, which resembles a lot, correct me if I'm wrong, the original JPORA, is that, do I got the letters right there?
JCPOA.
JCPOA, okay, I got most of them. Yeah. I feel like I'm taking an eye exam. So then why not just end it? What I understand, if both sides realize it's not going to get any better, why are we prolonging this?
Well, because so they both realize that they're not going to get significantly better, but there are still, because the talks have lots of things to settle, they are still trying to sort of jockey for position on these further talks, right? What I meant was they're not going to get sort of a better, Iran is not going to get a better ceasefire than they got, but they can still get sort of advantage in some of the negotiations. But you're right, there isn't a lot of sense in pushing much further. And as I mentioned the last time we spoke, I think Iran is miscalculating with these things. I think Iran is, they think that they have more leverage than they do, or they think that they have leverage now that they might not have later, which I think is correct. So they may be pushing just to see how much they can get right now. But if they push too far, it's gonna backfire on them.
Yeah,
which
and
may be happening now.
I guess maybe what I'm trying to say is it's different, and I used the car analogy before with you about buying a car and negotiating with the floor mats, and the floor mats are back in, they're out there. If you're just wasting a day screwing around at a car dealership, that's one thing. But we're talking about a lot of money here that affects a lot of people, human lives perhaps. And I just don't understand. At what point do cooler heads prevail, maybe, is what I'm asking.
Oh, dear. Yeah, that's a totally different question. So, as I said, you know, the analysis that I just gave is very much, you know, if we've got strategic people sitting in a room thinking through how this goes. But that's, of course, probably not what's happening. What's happening is there's domestic politics going on, not just in the United States, but also in Iran. There are hardliners in Iran who think that they can get a better deal the same way that President Trump thought that he could get a bit better deal than the JCPOA and pulled out of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we've got now is a struggle going on within the Iranian leadership over how things should go. And it's not entirely clear. You know, one of the interesting things about all this is that the Iranian government has not directly taken responsibility for any of these strikes on the ship. They've kind of responded afterwards by saying, well, you know, they weren't listening to warnings. They were in violation of our requirements. But what that indicates to me is that there may be some disagreement within the leadership over how this should be going, and that maybe there are elements that are firing off these missiles and drones that are maybe not coordinating with the negotiators. So that creates an extra layer of complexity in the negotiation.
All right. So what are the odds that 2 weeks from now you and I are having this exact same conversation?
Very high.
Yeah, I thought so. Thank you, Lindsay.
That's the latest on violence overseas. Here at home, the 4th of July came and went without any major bouts of mass violence, which these days counts as noteworthy. But one community didn't escape unscathed. Buffalo, New York is reeling. Here's WBEN.
I'm Susan Rose.
I'm Brian Masurowski.
A frustrated President Trump now says he believes the MOU with Iran and possibly the ceasefire are over. The president speaking at the NATO summit in Turkey, and Rachel Scott is there.
This morning, President Trump declaring the deal he signed with Iran just 3 weeks ago is now dead, calling the negotiations a waste of time.
To me, I think it's over. I don't want to deal with them anymore. They're scum. You know what scum is? They're scum. They're sick people. They're led by sick people.
Overnight, Iran and the U.S. trading fire. Tehran launching attacks across the region, targeting U.S. military sites in Bahrain and Kuwait.
The president saying he would be willing to allow his negotiating team to try to keep working, but again, he thinks it is a waste of time.
Well, Buffalo Mayor Sean Ryan spoke yesterday for the first time since the violence on the 4th of July that saw 11 gunshot victims transported to the hospital. He says most of the chaos they blame on one unnamed promoter.
This individual saw the mayhem that was created last year. Different members of the community sought him out. We had him meeting with business development people. We had him meeting with legitimate concert promoters and said, here is a way to take your following and to do something productive. He chose to do something unproductive, something chaotic, something harmful to the neighborhoods, and something that led to a lot of violence. So anything we can pin on this guy, we are going to pin on him.
Ryan continued to say that it was not only Buffalo residents that were responsible for this.
There's people with bumper stickers on cars. You know, we did license plate runs on cars and it showed where they lived. It's not just a Buffalo event. So people are coming from outside. We need to talk to parents about where their kids are going with their cars on 4th of July. This was youth from all over Erie County. There was Ubers dropping people off. There were people from the suburbs dropping off children.
It's the mayor yesterday, his first comments since the violent holiday weekend.
Other lawmakers in Buffalo reacting. Here's WBEN's Brayton Wilson.
Fillmore District Councilman Mitch Nowakowski feels in order to better prepare and avoid future street takeovers and violence that erupted this 4th of July weekend in Buffalo, it comes down to monitoring information, calls, and social media, and then assigning any available resources to address the matter.
I think where I get frustrated is we look for answers, but if you look at the information, somebody that was either 13 and then up to a 15 51-year-old were hurt, and the police commissioner said there was oftentimes a majority of young people. We need to be able to embrace our young people, know where they're at, provide them a safe place so that it's not so easy to look at social media and then gravitate towards things that could ultimately put them in danger.
Maston District Councilwoman Zanetta Everhart agrees with Nowakowski, saying it's about addressing the root causes of crime among the youth and why it floods out into the streets of Buffalo.
I've said this a million times. It's not the gun violence. It's the issues that come before the gun violence. Just like we talk about the kids fighting in schools. It's not the fight in the school. It's what happened at home before the kid got to school. And so if we're going to talk about gun violence, we need to talk about what resources are out there in the community for the kids. What's out there? There is nothing.
That's why Everhart is hosting an emergency strategy session on Wednesday to further discuss those resources and ensure that adults are helping find solutions and answers to help kids this summer.
Where are the adults? Why aren't we sitting at tables? Why aren't we opening up more buildings? Why aren't we putting more money into programming, into neighborhoods, into communities? That is the solution. I truly am tired of hearing about the gun violence. I want to know what the adults in the city of Buffalo are going to do to provide spaces for these young people to do things in.
Summer heat can bring violence and unrest. It can also be dangerous for people who like to stay active. Here's KYW.
Hey, y'all. I'm Maddie.
And I'm Poodle.
And together, we host the podcast Reality Gaze.
We are two ridiculous homosexuals who love nothing more than talking about reality television
and tearing in a new one. So whether it's 90 Day Fiancé, Love is Blind, Love After Lockup, or any other trash TV show about lonely hearts looking for love, your gay besties got you covered, y'all.
New shows every week. Follow and listen to Reality Gaze wherever you
it's
get your podcast.
Let's love
Philly.
The summer heat is here. Here's what you need to do to stay healthy. I'm Dr. Brian McDonough, KYW News Radio medical editor. We're in a situation now, especially the summer seem to be getting hotter and hotter. And as a result of that, we got to be more careful. And there's a lot of reasons for that. First of all, if you're just somebody who's going outside to exercise, try to think about what time of day you're going out. Go out in the early morning, go out in the early evening. Take advantage of it being at least a little cooler. And also, the most important thing you can do is hydrate. If you're going to go out and exercise when it's really hot, please hydrate and continue to hydrate. And the interesting thing about that is you have to drink a lot more than you think you do. So overdo it. And believe me, you won't regret it. The other thing is, if you're going to go out and exercise in the heat, use common sense. This isn't the time that you want to set your record. You want to pace yourself. Honestly, with so many indoor places to go, you might want to take advantage of those types of locations. I know during the summer you want to get outside, but you got to be careful about that. And one last thing, make sure you have a hat on or something for the surface area of the head to kind of cover and block a little bit of that sun. That will also be helpful as well.
Moving your body is one way to stay healthy in summer, but so is dieting. And the newest weight loss drugs are having a wide-ranging effect on the way we eat. Here's KCBS in the Bay Area.
Reduced appetite is expected when using weight loss medications, but what about taste loss? Nestle is reworking some of its food recipes to appeal to palates dulled by GLP-1 drugs. Phil Lempert, food industry analyst. Well, it seems like we're learning something every day. I never knew that it was actually going to change the palate to use these drugs, first of all. But given that, what is Nestle going to do to appeal to these people?
Well, what Nestle is doing is they're having smaller portion sizes, they're increasing the amount of protein, and they're adding more spices to break through that palate that needs to be cleansed. And they're not the only ones. ConAgra is doing it. Actually, Kroger has set up a whole store brand line for GLP-1 users as well.
But if you're going to punch up those flavors to break through a dulled palate, doesn't that risk alienating? I mean, what is it? 12% of the people are on a GLP-1 drug, so 80-something aren't. Do you risk marginalizing people who are your main customers?
I don't think so, because they're not replacing existing products with these new products. What they're doing is they've developed a whole new product line, especially for those GLP-1 users.
It's so interesting. Do you think that improved flavors will push more people to snack when they're trying to lose weight?
No, I don't. In fact, if we take a look, you know, sales are down. It depends on where in the country, but between 6 and 8% grocery sales as a result of GLP-1. And it's really more about a lifestyle change. You know, these people are losing weight. They're buying new clothes. They're sending their old clothes over to, you know, the Real and places like that. You know, dinner time in restaurants is down as a result. And in fact, J.P. Morgan puts about $30 to $55 billion in annual food and beverage industry sales at risk as GLP-1 adoption continues to grow.
Oh, that's amazing. You mentioned earlier about the protein that's been on the rise. Are they going to market it this way, or are they just going to put the protein in there?
No, they're marketing it that way. GLP-1 users typically are looking for more protein, smaller portion sizes, more protein. So they're marketing it. They're flagging it on the front of the package. They want these users because they also know, you know, their flagship brands are declining, legacy brands are declining. So if you can get these new GLP-1 users to lock onto your brand, you're going to have a really good business.
What are the other ways that food companies could market to people on GLP-1s? And they're going to be on them for life.
They are. And what we're seeing is also a rise in retail dietitians who are helping people on GLP-1. So the retailers are really taking a much more proactive look than even some of the CPG companies. Hy-Vee, for example, in the Midwest, you know, they have a whole GLP-1 program. And we're going to see more and more retailers do that. You know, it's basically what we're seeing, and it depends on the survey that you look at, but now about 18% of U.S. adults are using GLP-1 medication. That was 14% last year. And a lot of these are younger people, you know, age 35 to 50.
I didn't realize it was that high. That is high.
Yep.
That's amazing. That's 1 in 6.
Yeah. Well, and keep in mind that as the prices come down, and also, you know, I believe that not sure what the date is, but Medicare is going to start selling it for $50 a dose as well.
Yeah, well,
so
I mean, I guess
we're going to see a lot of older people on Medicare doing it as well.
Yes, and I know people who haven't been able to afford it and are on Medicare and so aren't taking it. So, I mean, I guess that's good if they can get healthier.
If you're trying to keep kids entertained on hot summer days, reading is a great activity. But should you pay them to do it? Here's Adam and Jordana at WCCO in Minneapolis.
A company called Dirt Road Academy, and the father, the inspiration behind it, put together just kind of a little enticing thing. Would you pay your kid $4,000 to read 40 books? Come on. This gets them off the doom scrolling, gets them off doing that, maybe learning something, maybe enjoying the aspect of reading, and then they get a financial reward. Alan Martin with Dirt Road Academy. Okay, you got us thinking about this. Give us your inspiration for even suggesting the idea of paying a kid $4,000 to read 40 books.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, it's good to be here. Well, you know, my kids were already reading fiction, right, at home and in school, but there was this huge gap in financial literacy, daily habits, critical thinking, relationships, communication, resilience, you know, really designing their own life that I knew wasn't being taught in school, and I didn't expect it to be taught in school. And we had actually watched a dear family member, my sibling, closest in age to me, completely succumb to drug addiction. And so I was raising my young kids as this was happening and thought, you know what? What do we do to provide them a little better operating system? Maybe to provide them the shot that he didn't have. And I put together this list and I presented them a simple question. Would you read 40 books for $4,000? And I tell you what, that opens up a super interesting conversation about life, about preparing for adulthood, and kind of just having the best shot that you can. And so that's where it came from, just watching my own kids and hoping, you know, what could we do to give them the best shot possible?
Okay, I have a lot of questions. First of all, you got to have $4,000 for each of your kids. That's a lot of money. How did you come up with that figure?
So in reality, you're already paying your kids to do lots of things, right? Chores, random things, money kind of leaks out everywhere. So I'm like, look, there's already a lot of money heading toward the kids anyway, especially in their teenage years. So why not give them the chance to earn up themselves, right? And I'm like, it has to be $100 because, you know, you think about the screen, the doom scrolling, the short form video algorithm, something has to be strong enough to really push back against that and stop them in their tracks. And I don't know what it is, but the psychology of a $100 bill stops them in their tracks. They'll put down the phone and say, I'm ready to listen. Let's do this challenge.
What?
It has to be an amount that matters.
I bet. I mean, the kids, I can see them jumping on this, but why? Why do we need to reward kids this way for doing things that they should be doing anyway, reading these books? And does this then create an adult later who then says, what am I getting paid for this? Or, you know, that kind of thing for everything. Do you worry about that a little?
Well, 100%. So, and I will tell you, this is the number one thing that parents push back on when they talk to me. But I step back and look at it this way. There's $40 billion a year in engineering payroll to keep our kids and to keep people on screen, right? Swiping the short form video. They call it the $1 trillion algorithm. That's how much it is at stake for tech companies to keep people on their phones and scrolling. So the way that we put it is your teenager is in an unfair fight. They're up against massive tech companies. And so without some kind of incentive, it's like, what, you know, will they actually break the pattern in their mind? Will they actually do these things, read these books, kind of prepare for adulthood without some kind of incentive? My argument is it's far more difficult today than it ever has been. The doom scrolling isn't just by accident or for fun. It is absolutely by design. And the cash incentive is enough to push back against it.
Okay, let's talk about some of the 40 books. What have you got on this list?
Oh my gosh. So I'll tell you the one that I've read recently that I think is just totally fascinating. It's called The Four Agreements. And it's so interesting. It's a very, very short read, just a little over 100 pages. But it teaches kids four very simple things. One, be impeccable with your word. Two, don't take anything personally. Three, don't make assumptions. Be curious and ask questions instead. And four, always do your best. I know that sounds super simple, but like internalizing those things young as they're heading into adulthood can make all the difference. There's some absolute old greats on the list, like How to Win Friends and Influence People. And, you know, as adults, we've come across that book and read it, but it's like, it just explains such simple things. You can't win an argument. If you're wrong, admit it. Take real true interest in the people around you and see, you know, how that unfolds for you. These are really these lessons that we come across in adulthood, but the truth is our teenagers really don't bump into these things until much later in life unless we unlock these for them earlier.
How many kids do you have, Alan?
So I have five of my own, and I'm in a blended family, and so two others. So there are seven kids here.
Oh, my gosh. This is going to be expensive.
Holy cow. We're deep in it.
Wow. How do you know that the kids actually read the book? Because do you have a test for them?
Totally. So with every single book, I developed a workbook, which breaks the book into four learnable parts. And so we call them missions, but it, you know, comprehension questions, a couple of reflection questions, and these are books that they actually handwrite in. It's an offline experience. And so it's very different than anything else in their life. It's slower. It's hard. It's a challenge. It's offline. But there's a workbook that goes with every book and they work through it. And that actually helps the learning stick for them. And as a parent, it helps me understand that they, you know, really picked something up.
Okay. 4,000 is a lot. I'll just keep mentioning that. How would you amend this? And what other suggestions would you have for people to incentivize reading and really broadening and understanding for some of these things like financial literacy? I'm all for that.
Yeah, no kidding. So a lot of families, I will just say, I've been, first of all, kind of shocked how many families have jumped onto this, have downloaded the list, are now using Dirt Road Academy. And they incentivize in all kinds of different ways. Sometimes they're doing rewards like activities. They're doing $5 or $10 a book. And some families are pushing all of the money into a future graduation all or nothing bonus. And so it's like, look, if you read through this whole track, there's an all or nothing bonus at the end. And so the reality is every kid truly is, you know, themselves. And so you just have to kind of know your kid and know what it is that's going to help them kind of get over the line and get into some of these books. But we see families using this in all kinds of different ways.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.